Good evening, everyone. My name is Peter Fleisch, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. You know, I'm amazed, and I'm overwhelmed. I don't even know why I'm here. I know I don't want to be here. I love being asked. I hate to go. And I'm sitting up here, and I'm watching these lights flashing out here. And I remember what it was like. Oh, colors, man. And, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, we are truly alcoholic, aren't we? I don't want to shock this group, but, you know, July isn't spring. I'm sure I'm not the first person to point that out. But I just felt I had to say that. First, I want to thank Clem for asking me to come here. Clem doesn't know me from a hole in the wall. He asked me to come here on a recommendation of a gentleman by the name of Paul C., who is a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous in my local area. And I'm gonna get Paul for that. And I got this letter, and it said Mark Bellows is going to come and pick me up. And I went, I remember him. You know, and I was sharing this journey that I was going to take with a gentleman who's on the podium here, Pete. And you know, Pete and I used to get drunk together. And I watched Mark walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be blessed to hear some people share from the podium this weekend who were absolutely the most influential people in my life. I'm one of those people who love to sit in these rooms and just take it all in. I don't think I have much to say because, you know, it's already been said. And I'm not an authority or an expert in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it says in here that Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Since I'm not an authority, just a member, I have an opinion on everything. And I'm going to share it with you tonight. And if that pisses you off, well, so be it. Fortunately, I'm not the last speaker of this conference, so, you know, by tomorrow morning, everybody will go, who was that guy? Oh, what the hell, you know. We'll go listen to the next one. You know, and if anything I say tonight you can't reconcile, do two things. Please, do two things. First, read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our basic text. That is your lifeline to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And second, go to another meeting. It's as simple as that. If you didn't hear what you hear tonight, go to another meeting. You will hear it eventually. And if that person gets up there and shares their experience and it's not yours, that's okay. The next one might be just the person you need to hear. You know, and I don't know why people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't even know why people stay. I know how it works, though. There's a whole chapter. It says how it works. I always marvel at people at meetings. They go, I don't know how this thing works. Chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail. Oh, son of a gun. You know, I was a blackout drinker. I'm also a blackout speaker. About 8 or 10 minutes into this thing, I don't know what I'm going to say, and it really doesn't matter. I believe that I'm going to shut my head off and let God talk through me. Whatever comes out, it's His business. My life is His business. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't come here because I was alcoholic. I came here through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. I'm an adult child of a functional family. I've come to find out the true dysfunction in that family was me. As I have looked at it through a few years of sobriety, I have realized that, you know, they weren't wrapped too tight. And who is? You know, and it doesn't really matter. I know today more about my life in retrospect than I did at the time. I mean, I didn't have a clue what was going on. I know today that, because the book says so, that I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I thought I was just pissed off. You know, I was nervous and edgy, and I didn't like who I was, where I was, and where I was going. Now, the book defines that differently. Oh, okay, those are nice words. You know, I've come to find out that most people that I've encountered in Alcoholics Anonymous seem to have the same kind of emotions. You know, and why I drank. I don't know why you drank. I drank because the book tells me exactly. I drank essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. Now, if you're one of those people that came to AA, and I've heard them, they stand up at podiums and meetings and sit around and go, "From my very first drink, I never had a good time." Now, that's sad. If you didn't have a good time early in your drinking, you got screwed. I loved getting loaded. I never got, you know, I never went out for a drink. I like those people, you know. I think we'll go out tonight for a cocktail. I went out to get snuckered. I mean, I wanted to get shit-faced, and that was it. And I only knew one kind of drinking. That's more. That's all I ever knew. You know, I grew up, you know, in a small town back east, feeling odd, goofy, and different. And that little town's called New York City. And I grew up in a neighborhood called Harlem. Now, you look like I do, and you live in that neighborhood, you're going to feel odd, goofy, and different. Simple as that. Didn't occur to me, though. I didn't know much about me or any of this kind of stuff. I do believe, though, that I can't determine when my alcoholism started. I've heard people share that. I'm amazed. I mean, I just sit there amazed. They said, "June 7th, 1963, at 3:30 in the afternoon, at Lucky's Bar, I took that bourbon and water and became an alcoholic." Wow. I can't even remember where my house is. You know. I was just at the psychiatrist two days ago, because I'll share with you later why. It's got a very nice story here, folks. Don't jump to conclusions, please. And he asked, he said, "Well, how many times have you been married?" I looked at my wife and I went, "I don't know, 5, 6, something like that." His eyes got as big as plates. You know, "What are their names?" "I don't know." "Well, when last did you get married?" I said, "The current one I know. Before that, it's all kind of a haze. I don't know how I became alcoholic. I know that when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. That's all I really know. I know that anything I share with you tonight is really unimportant except for one thing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the most passionate thing I'm about in my entire life. I will defend this program with every fiber of my being. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing in the world for me. And I'm duty-bound and responsible to maintain its integrity for the next person who walks into this room."
Right on. Woo!
Fortunately, I walked into some people in Alcoholics Anonymous that were crusty old son of a guns. You know, they didn't fool around with this deal. They thought Alcoholics Anonymous worked just fine. "We don't need your opinion. Have a seat. Shut up." I said, I want to share. They said, we know. I need to tell you about my first drink. I'll tell you about my last drink and a couple in between because they're really unimportant. They all seem to blend together. Everything happened about the same. Circumstances, places, people change, but the same pattern. My first drink, it was Christmas 1952. I was 2 years old. And we were at my little friend Eric's house down the street, and they thought it'd be cute to give the kids some eggnog. And they gave Eric a glass, they gave me a glass. And Eric took his first drink, and he did what most people do, including alcoholics. He took a sip, and he went like this. I thought that was an odd reaction. Didn't deter me. I took my first sip, and I did this. And a pattern started that night, which stayed with me until I was the age of 34, until I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked mine, and then I liked yours. I went around the room liking everyone else's. And my behavior seemed to change. And it was a little odd, and for the sake of everybody else's well-being, they thought it would be best to lock Peter up in another room. That's another pattern that stayed with me for a long time. I got the names of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they put me and Eric in his parents' bedroom, and they gave us a ball to play with. And we played with the ball for a little bit, and the ball rolled under his parents' bed. And I wanted the ball back. And I couldn't see it. Back then, they used lit candles on Christmas trees. So I, this keen alcoholic mind of mine and a few drinks in me, I popped off one of those candles, looked under the bed. And I saw the ball. Unfortunately, the bed caught on fire. Then the drapes caught on fire. And the house burned down. And that was my first drink. Now, I should have rushed at the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been a true newcomer in every sense of the word. But you see, I didn't know what the problem was. And if you don't know what the problem is, then coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is not going to help. See, I believe that we have a circle and a triangle, which is our symbol. And if you're relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to look at that and you're going to see unity, service, and recovery. A triangle and a circle around it. And you're going to look at that and go, what? And I did for a bunch of years until people pointed it out to me. And that's not important. So I had to come up with something else. See, I need visualization for me. And so I looked at that triangle. And I said, what could it possibly mean? And so one leg of that triangle turned out to be what the problem was. And the second leg of that triangle turned out to be what the solution is. See, knowing I'm an alcoholic is not going to keep me sober. Then also knowing that I'm an alcoholic and there's a program called Alcoholics Anonymous that I should go to is not going to keep me sober. But if I put the third leg into place, which is a planned program of action, I can have permanent sobriety a day at a time. So I just had to find out what the problem was. And so for most of my life, I was out there looking for what the problem was. And I'm not one of those people that look introspectively. I'm not one of those deep thinkers and sit there and say, let me see what my part in this was. I say, you did it to me. You're at fault. Them. You know, I blamed everyone and everything possibly about who I was. You know, and growing up, I see things and then I react to things. That's how I, you know, I learn. And I watched these two people called my mother and father, you know, raise this ungrateful person. And I mean, I watched my father do something that was just, even today I'm amazed at. He went to work every day. This man got up at 4:45 every single day. And he had one job. Just one job. Went to it every day, came home. Went to it every day, came home. Went to it every day, came home. Boring. And he came home to the same woman, my mother. He's only married to one woman. Think about that. What a dull life. One job, one woman. If I was him, I wouldn't come home to her. I was stuck. I had no place else to go. I'm five, you know. You got a car. Go somewhere, for God's sakes. He had words. He used words that were just... They made me cringe, you know. Things like commitment, loyalty, duty, responsibility. Ooh! You know, I realized that I needed to do something with my life, and I really didn't know what it was. And, you know, I was one of those kids that floated around in school. I can remember I was in my... I guess in third grade, and Mrs. Orens, my teacher, I'm sure she's dead now. I hope she's dead now. See, you misconstrued. She was a very, very old woman many, many, many years ago. I would be looking at her suffering and her pain today. She had me tested. You know, back then that was a big thing. They test those kids and they look at the scores and they bring your parents and, you know, you get that stupid note, you know, and they give it to me and said, bring it to your parents. And so they gave me the note and I threw it away. And then I expected my parents to show up and they didn't. And they said, you bring that note? Uh-huh. They gave me another note. I threw it away. Then they pinned it to you, you know, you got to go home with it. And they sat my parents down and I heard her say something. I heard her say something. And I used what she said for years. Decades, actually. She said, you know, Peter has such wonderful potential. If he'd only apply himself. And I lived on that potential for a long time. Now, I'm not the brightest bulb on the porch. Unlike Matt, who, like, I mean, he got it wired quick, you know. I mean, and I'm sitting here absolutely amazed. I mean, a gremlin showed up. I wouldn't know if I'd get in it. I've been seeing gremlins for years. And... I'm sitting in one of these meetings and I'm listening to this guy share and he talks about potential. And I'm like, perking up. Yeah. Me and him were brothers. The potential twins, you know. And he said, I now know what potential is. And I perked up because I needed a new definition. Because it was kind of wearing thin. And he says, potential is that at the present time, you're not worth a shit. Wasn't good information. But when I sat there and thought about it, I said, you know, he's absolutely right. And so I don't have as much potential as I used to have. And so I went about living my life. You know, I didn't do well in school, and I didn't think there was much in it for me there. And when I decided to kind of leave, they weren't too terribly upset. And they were, you know, you have to have a career plan. You have to have a path. You got to do something with your life, don't you? I mean, because I like stuff. I'm a big fan of stuff. My sponsor, Barney, talks about stuff all the time. You know, I got to have my stuff, which is better than your stuff. So you recognize how good my stuff is and therefore my net worth. And if my stuff looks a little shabby, I got to get some new stuff. So it's all about stuff. There's a lot of stuff in this thing. So I need stuff, and how am I going to get stuff? I mean, I'm not going to do what my father did. That's work. That's a hideous thing. And it's, you know, far beneath the likes of me. So I had to look for some kind of career opportunity. And you'll hear later on from another speaker that, you know, I used to do the same thing he did. I used to find things that weren't officially lost yet. It's a cumbersome job. Somebody's got to do it. And I didn't really like that a whole lot. because you got to put your stuff somewhere until somebody wants to buy your stuff, and then you got to get a price for your stuff, and they don't even know that they need the stuff that you have, so you can sell them the stuff. It's a lot. So I decided I had to switch occupations, and I decided to become a I got in the import-export business. I became a commodities broker. And see, I knew a long time before I came to this program, if you want what I have and you're willing to go to any length to get it. And that's what I used to do. And, there are some really fine people and members of Alcoholics Anonymous who, you know, worked every day. I was not one of them. I went out and did my thing with this substance. And the substance changed as the, you know, time went on, and whatever was the hot commodity I would dip into and move around. You have to move around a lot. You don't really have to be paranoid to know that they are, in fact, after you. So the 60s were going on, and you could blend in with that, and you could be a hippie, you could be a beatnik, you can blend. But the problem is that they seemed to outlast me. And because of my career path and decisions and occupation, I ran into a few difficulties along the way. Now, I never meant to run into those difficulties. And that's why I told you through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, most of my life I seemed to get in trouble. Now, I didn't mean to get in trouble. It just happened. You know, and some of those times, you know, I need to share with you because this is the person who's standing in front of you. There was a time I was getting out, the Rahway Penitentiary in New Jersey. And I said to myself when I was visiting there that I wasn't going to go back there again for what I had done. And, you know, I was always going to do it differently. This time it's going to be different. That was my cry. It's going to be different. I'm going to be better at it. Not this time. And so, you know, leaving that place, I didn't make a whole lot of friends. I had burned everybody that I had known, and no one was going to pick me up. You know, it wasn't my first visit, and it wasn't going to be my last. And walking out of that penitentiary, I, you know, had a suit of clothes on, not quite as nice as what I'm wearing today, and I had a few dollars for making license plates. I have a great deal of respect for license plates, by the way. I did learn that in prison. They said goodbye and said the bus stop is that away. And I took this long walk to the bus stop, and I happened to notice at the corner of that bus stop is a, right in that corner is a bar. A bar. Son of a gun. Now I walked into that bar saying to myself, self, we're going to have one drink. You know, that one drink that we have. See, I did not know. I had not read this book. I did not know that I had a disease, which is twofold in nature, analogy of the mind and obsession of the body. I didn't know any of that. I just knew I was thirsty. I was very thirsty. You've been in that place, you'd be thirsty too. So I went in for one drink. I didn't know that one drink led to another drink. And I didn't realize at the time, because I hadn't done an inventory, and that I drink to out. Knocked out, thrown out, passed out. That's what I drink. I drink to out. I just drink to excess. I'm a pig. So I ordered one drink. And I remember that drink. I remember it burning on the way down. I remember it bubbling on the way back up. I remember feeling good. I knew that alcohol was good. And so I said, I'll have another, and another, and another, and another. Well, unfortunately, I ran out of money. And I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling lonely. I'm feeling sad. I'm holding on to this empty glass, and, you know, 6 feet away is everything that I need to get me where I want to go. And I just can't get there. Most of my life, I feel like I've been pressed up against a glass, and just right over there is where it's going on, and I'm stuck on the other side, and I can't get through that barrier. And some guy taps me on the shoulder and says, you out of money, aren't you, kid? And I said, yep. He says, I know where all the booze and money you could possibly need is. I said, where's that? He says, there's a liquor store down the street. We can rob it and get everything we want. Now, I should have been able to say to him, excuse me, this is not a very healthy idea. See that large gray building? don't want to go back. The answer was, you bet. 8 hours later, I was back in that penitentiary. And what really upset me is when I got back there, the prison guard said to me, what took you so long? Another time, you know, I was in the Bellevue Hospital for the criminally insane. Wearing that suit of clothes was mentioned, one size fits all. Kind of sliding around on those paper slippers doing the Thorazine shuffle. Thought it was good acid. I don't know how I got there. You know, and I managed to always survive, escape, do these things. I tried every solution that this solid brain could come up with. I tried getting married and getting married and getting married. And if you can figure out how many times it is, let me know, because I got the shrink who's dying to get the right answer. It seems to be important to him. I don't know. I tried moving. My answer was, when the heat's on, put your rags in your bags, let your feet hit the street. Just keep moving. It's hard to hit a moving target. That's it. You know, I didn't know where I was going to, and I didn't care. I just knew that it wasn't where I was at. I was one of those people that I'd kind of look at the broad spectrum of life and see those people over there and said, they got it. And I'd pack up whatever I had and went over there. And when I got there, they seemed to move. And they went over there. And so I would go over there, and then they'd move over here. And I mean, I was always just missing it. I don't know what it was, but I was just always seemingly missing it. And so I got married again, and this time I came out to San Diego, California, and with another wife. And, you know, she was going to go to school and get a job and you know, have a life. And, you know, I was just kind of a fill-in. And I'd go with anybody that had any kind of... If you had two glasses that matched, that's furniture. I'm going with you. You had a sense of direction. We'd be buds. You know, and I meant it. I always meant it. I meant to be committed this time. I meant it to be disciplined. I don't know what happened. I had a drinky poo. And it all flitted away. Because I liked it. And I didn't know that one drink led to another. And so, you know, we moved into this condominium in Mission Valley. And, I mean, I watched this woman in one day, park the vehicle, have people waiting, unpacked all the furniture, put it in its proper place, unpacked all the dishes and all that good stuff, went, got, registered for school, and got a job in one day. I was so exhausted watching her. And walking around this place, I noticed these people in this bubbling water, and they were drinking. I didn't know what it was, but I found my people. They seemed to be having no problems that day. So I slipped in and you know, I just started to hang out with them. And you know, sooner or later, those wives start asking those questions. You know those questions like, are you going to get a job? Oh, yeah. I'm working on my resume. I don't have a resume. I don't know who's really interested in looking for me either. I'm not sure the Bureau of Weights and Measures is looking for anybody today. Yeah, that's a kilo. No problem. And so when the pressure's on, I have to go. And so I went, and I went to the, you know, as long as she was giving me money, I went to nice bars. And when the money started getting less, I went to other not-so-nice bars. And I found my people again. And they wanted something, and I had some old connections, and I started to go back into the business that I know best. Now, I'm going to share this with you because it doesn't make me any different than anybody else in this room, but that particular venture I started to do pretty well. I was, you know, I started to connect with some people that were directly importing this stuff from South America. We brought it in, you know, by the carload, and then the boatload, and the trainload, and the plane load, and we brought it in by the shipload, is really. And, you know, we had piles of everything. I mean, I was doing really well. And, of course, the wife had to go, and the mistress had, and the girlfriend. And, you know, we just moved on. And, you know, and I measured my success buy the stuff that I had. So I had a red Ferrari with license plates that said SDR, and R stood for sex, drugs, rock and roll. I wore black leather suits in the middle of the night wearing dark sunglasses trying to be anonymous. I brought the band home. You know, we traveled the world. I mean, I was a success by some standards. See, I had what you wanted, and you're willing to go to any length to get it. Now, I want you to know that people will stand up and talk to you about the narcotic effect of alcohol, and it is, in fact, true. Very narcotic. And so is cocaine, and so is heroin, but I will tell you, and so is money, and so is sex. But I will tell you, for me, the most narcotic effect of anything that ever came down the pike for me was power. I loved the power. See, I had absolute power of life and death over you, and periodically I'd flex my will. And that's just the way it was. And I had people around me who made sure that I was not harmed. So be it. But see, I didn't realize that I had this progressive disease and I wasn't doing all that well. And I started to turn into an animal. I became so obsessed with me, you know, it was sickening. And so to the culmination of truly who in fact I am or was at the time, more importantly, because there was a time we were in Palm Springs, and I don't really relish telling this and I don't often do it, but I need to let you know who I am because you are my family. And I keep no secrets from you. None. Zero. And I don't care what it does to me. Well, you need to know who I am, because you're going to tell me who you are, and that's the only way we're going to heal each other. Is that we were playing cards, and we were in this very fancy suite, and we had a large pile of white and green, and we had just successfully completed a deal, and these are my business associates, my closest compadres. And we're playing poker, and the guy bet a sum of money, and he looked at me and says, "Do you have it or you don't?" And I said, "It's poker, bet and find out." And he asked me again, and I'm sure that the conversation escalated and the verbiage was somewhat different than I'm sharing with you today. And it just kept going on, and finally he annoyed me and he looked at me and he said, "Listen, you cheap Jew bastard, do you have it or you don't?" And I just reached in my coat and went boom, and I put a slug into his chest. I remember flying out of the chair and slamming up against the wall and sliding down and blood everywhere. And I can tell you exactly what I felt. Nothing. I looked over and the next guy said, "He's out. It's your bet." And he folded. And I took what was mine by right of possession and conquest. Now, although my success on the outside seems to do somewhat well, financially, I was dying. And I no longer lived in the fancy houses. I was living in the stash houses. And I was no longer drinking socially. I was, because I never knew what a social drink was anyway. But I mean, I was just drinking and hiding. I was hiding from my own people. I was guzzling it. I was sticking things in my body. I was making holes that God didn't create. I was trying to get there. And I could never get there. I didn't wake up ever. I just came to. I was dying. I used to sit with a loaded automatic weapon in my lap thinking, if you had the guts, pull the trigger. Let's just end this game. You can't stand your life, and neither can anyone else. But I didn't do that, or you'd have another speaker. And along came a day in April of 1984. April 18th, 1984, as a matter of fact. And I had to leave the stash house because a little stupid kilo deal was going down for a cocktail waitress, a friend of mine. Believe me, we didn't do that. We played in the hundreds of, and this was just a onesie. And it was just for a favor. And I went to a bar, and figuring the deal was over, I left the bar and, you know, get my car brought up. And this alcoholic came up to me. Now, I don't know what an alcoholic is. I have no idea. I have an idea in my mind what it is, but I didn't know what it is. An alcoholic is somebody who lives in the street and lives in a dumpster and is filthy and is dirty and pees his pants and, you know, eats out of garbage cans. That's what an alcoholic is, right? So this thing shows up, and I said, "Oh, look at this. Let me give him a few dollars. I'm feeling sorry for him." He pulls back his coat, sticks a sword off under my throat and says, "DEA." Has me lay on the ground, and I'm begging him just to blow my brains out. Just splatter him all over the asphalt. There's not a living human being that would care. Please, please! Well, obviously, he didn't do that. He took me to jail. And in jail, they are very efficient. They took everything that I was away. Everything that I had went like that. Gone in an instant. Well, I'm in jail and I don't know what to do. And they came to me with a proposition, and I told them that I couldn't do that proposition because it's poor for my health. And they said, that's the only way you're ever going to get out of here. And I said, okay. And so I made a deal with them, and I when they let me out, I kind of ducked them and dodged them, and I called up my business associates and I said, we have a problem, and I'm it. And I told them exactly where I was going to be. And I waited on the street corner for them. And I sat there and waited for 8 hours. Now, in my world, loose ends don't stay loose for too long. And a miracle in my life happened that day when I didn't have the eyes to see, the ears to hear, a heart to feel anything. They didn't come, and I can't tell you why. And from what I understand, they've come many times before and many times after. And they just left me there. And I don't know about you, but I was lost. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. And all I could think of is I needed a drink, one drink. So I went looking for a drink, and there was no one who would give me anything. I no longer had what you wanted. You weren't willing to even be around me. So I knew somebody whose house, and I went in, and I broke in, and I stole his daughter's piggy bank. His 3-year-old daughter, I broke it on the floor, and I took the nickels and dimes and pennies, and I went for one drink, and that was on April 19th, 1984. Just one drink. I didn't know I had that disease. Just one. And I came to on May 18th, 1984, and I was living in a dumpster downtown San Diego. Across the street from that dumpster was the federal prison that I was going to go back to. I had my hand around some man's throat who was living in that dumpster with me. I was choking him to death because, see, he had what I wanted. It was a cheap bottle of wine, and he had a little bit left in it. And I had what perhaps some people say was just a small moment of clarity. And I said, oh my God, what happened? I have no recollection of that entire moment. None. And I walked from there to another part of that town. And it's a long, long walk. And I didn't smell too good, and I didn't look too good. And I don't know why I went to see this guy. I went to see, of all people, my insurance agent. I went to tell him in my own mind that I couldn't make the payments on the cars anymore. Seemed like the right thing to do at the time to me. And I walked in and they went, hold on a second. There's someone here to see you. And they brought me in and sat me down. And he said, Peter, what's the problem? And I went, He said, what? He said, look me in the eye and tell me what's going on. I said, well, I think I have a small problem with drugs and alcohol. And a smile came to his face from ear to ear. He stood up. He put his hand across the desk. He says, my name is Paul S. I'm a great recovering alcoholic. I have been waiting for you for 6.5 years. I said, what? He says, we got to get busy. What do you mean, busy? He says, we got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous right away. And I went, whoa. My case isn't that bad. You know, and he did what you just did. He laughed at me. And no one had laughed at me in a long time. And I reached in my belt for my laugh persuader. And my pants fell down. I didn't have a belt. I didn't look too cool there. And he said, this is what we're going to do, kid. You meet me at the corner at 6 o'clock. And if you're not there at 6:01, you can smell exhaust. Now get out of my office. Well, that was a tad harsh. I didn't fall into that group of Alcoholics Anonymous says, welcome, boo-boo. We're going to get you a job. And we're going to freshen you up. He says, if you want what we have, you'll do what we do and shut up. Ha ha. Now, of course, I'm a little arrogant. I don't know about you, but it seems that no matter how badly I'm defeated, the first thing that seems to pop back up is my ego and my arrogance. Like, instant. I don't think he truly understands my case. I'm not sure he's worthy of helping me. I think I'll go back to Balboa Park and look for a good spot. And that's what I did. And I went to another meeting. I won't share that with you, but, you know, I heard something there. I heard something. And I called the guy up the next day, and I said, I'll
try that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous.
He said, good. Be at the corner at 6 o'clock. If you're not there at 6:01, you'll smell exhaust. And he hung up. Didn't ask me where I was. Just told me to be there. So I was there. I don't know what time I got there. I didn't have a watch. It was still daylight. I just hung out. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on May 20th, 1984. And through the grace of God, this fellowship, and a lot of work on my part, I have not found it necessary to take a drink from then to now. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Now, it doesn't impress you, but it impresses me. And so we went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He put me in the car, and we drove and drove and drove and drove. And I knew where the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be. It was going to be in a basement of a burned-out church with a bare light bulb and 80-year-old men, you know, sitting there going, "Life is over." And I was willing to go there. And we're driving, and all of a sudden it occurs to me, we're in this, like, area. It's called Rancho Santa Fe, California. Now, I can't explain to you what it is, but, like, the people who own McDonald's live there. They drive through roads that have, like, real people holding lanterns in front of the places. These are things called estates. And we're driving through this thing, and we stop at this magnificent, beautiful, picturesque church. And I'm sitting in the car, and I'm looking at these Rolls Royces and Mercedes and Jaguars and stuff, and all these well-mannered and dressed and clean, coiffured people are walking in. And he gets out of the car, and I'm just sitting there. And he comes back to the car and says, "What are you doing, dummy?"
"Well, I'll wait till you're done, and then we'll go to the A&A meeting."
He says, "This is it. And do me a favor."
"What's that?"
"Don't talk to these people. They don't want what you have." And I followed this guy around. If he stopped short and I wasn't paying attention, "What? Are you bothering me again?" I mean, I was just there. And I heard them say that night, you know, "If you want what we have." And I looked around the room and like, And they called on me that night. That's what they do. And I stood up and I said, "I want what you have. But I want to know when you're out so I can steal it." And they laughed and said, "Keep coming back," and told me to sit down. And no one had told me to come back in a long, long time. And they made an announcement there. They said, "If you'd like a cake next week, see me after the meeting." Oh, I wanted a cake. I was hungry. So I went up to the woman and said, "I'd like a cake next week." And she said, "Aren't you new?" I had no idea how she could figure that out. Perhaps my dress was a little different than theirs, but, you know, I said, well, I think so. I'm not sure. I said, well, she didn't sit there and go, "Look, stupid," as I do, even now. She just said, "You know, we're going to have a cake next week, and you can share ours." Oh, okay. That was it. It was as simple as that. And next week I went there because they had cake. And I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous because they had cake and they had cookies and I was living in the park. And then I graduated and moved into a recovery home. And I lived there for, was going to go for a weekend. I was going to appease this guy and go for a weekend. just a weekend. Sit on the porch, feel miserable, go for a weekend. I was there for a year. A year and a day, the director of this place, a mean old son of a gun. His name was Hobie. And Hobie called me and said, "You're moving out." I said, I don't want to move out. This is pretty good here. He said, "We need the bed. You got a year of sobriety. You go to outside meetings. You got a sponsor. You got a job. Get out." Well, I'll work on my exit plan. He said, "We have. Your shit's on the porch." Oh. Now, as it turns out, that this sponsor that I had had a stepson who got drunk in San Diego and wound up getting a 502 and joining Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't like living with that miserable man who was my sponsor, who was his stepfather. And so we wound up getting a place together. Now, it turns out that Mark's first sponsor was the guy I lived with who was the stepson of my sponsor. And I come to Sacramento to see Mark. And if you don't think this is weird shit here, you can't get this entertainment for a buck. And I only joined Alcoholics Anonymous for a short period of time. See, I'm going to prison. I eventually had to face that judge and plead guilty. And much like this program, because some certain things that took place, and I pled guilty, and I went to plead guilty 12 times. And every time I would go there, something wasn't quite right in that system, and he would look at me and said, "Not yet. Come back next week." In his own way, he was saying, "Keep coming back." And I didn't know how long I could keep this job up. See, I didn't want to get a job. See, getting a job is something that I don't understand. That I don't fathom that kind of thing and being responsible. And so my sponsor said to me, he said, "You need to get a job." I said, "Well, I don't know what to do." He says, "What do you like to do every day?" And I said, "Eat." He said, "Get a job with food." So I got this job, and I didn't have a car. And I was an outside sales rep, and I couldn't take the bus, and I just didn't want to work. You know, truthfully, I didn't want to work. And I'd call him up all the time and said, "They're going to fire me." He said, "What do you mean they're going to fire me? I'm not working." He said, "Then you should be fired. Why don't you go to work?" "I don't, can't work." So we had this repetitive pattern going. So finally, I got the phone call from that boss, and he said, "Come on in and see me." And I knew he was going to fire me. I call up my sponsor and said, "What should I do?" He says, "Well, you owe him an amends." He says, "You have to work for him for free until you pay it back." "What?" He says, "Just do what I tell you." So we meet at Denny's, and he hands me a paycheck, and he says, "I'm sorry, Peter, you have such wonderful potential if you'd only apply yourself." And he hands me a paycheck, and I said, "Thank you very much, but my sponsor says that I have to work for you for free until I pay it back. So here's your money, and I'll just go to work, and whatever I make, you keep." He looks at me and says, No. "Me boss, you fired." No. "Sponsor said stay." "Boss says go." "Sponsor says stay." Finally, he was so confused, he said, "Just see me on Friday." You know, I still work for the same place. I now do the hiring. I got to pull people in the office periodically and tell them, you know, "You have wonderful potential if you'd only apply yourself." See, and that's not my job. That's Alcoholics Anonymous' job. I didn't get that job. I didn't know what to do here. I just went to these stupid meetings. I went with the worst attitude in the world. I hated what you said. I sat there and just growled and grimaced and just hated everybody. I was seething. I mean, the room could be packed and there are 5 seats left and right of me. You know, I don't know why. Nobody wanted to sit next to me. Eventually, I even got another gun and I used to carry it with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to keep it in my belt, and if you didn't share that I liked, I kind of showed it to you. And they'd just laugh at me. one night in a step study, I kind of had another spiritual experience, and I gave up my gun to somebody. Big old mean guy with a heart of gold. You know, I don't know what Alcoholics Anonymous is to you. You know, I heard a story just recently, a little quick one. It was about a guy stuck in a hole, deep, deep hole. And people are walking by, and he's screaming for help. And walks by a clergy, and he says, I need help. Get me out. He said, hold on. Writes him a prayer, throws it in the hole. Pray, it's my son. He's still stuck in the hole. He's screaming for help again. An attorney walks by, looks down and says, here's my card. Give me a call. I'm in the hole, you idiot. You know, a doctor comes by and writes him a prescription, throws it in. Nothing's working. Finally, he's screaming for help, and a guy looks down and says, what's the matter, buddy? He says, I'm stuck in this hole. He says, hold on. Takes a running start and just jumps right in the hole with him. The guy in the hole looks at him and says, hey, idiot, now there are two of us in this hole. He said, it's okay, buddy. I know the way out. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. When I was stuck in that hole, somebody jumped in and because they knew the way out. They took risks and life and limb, not because they felt noble, because it's our duty-bound responsibility. It says it in the big book. It's in Dr. Bob's nightmare. It's all over that. You know, people talk about the promises in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think there are hundreds of promises in that book. I'm not going to be so vain to quote them. But on page 75, it says that we're building an arch to walk a free man. It is my favorite page in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they got me involved in these things called the steps. And the steps, obviously, was a very painful process because it asked of me things that were not of my nature. And it started talking about, first I had to recognize in there, and I just love people who say, all you need to know is the first 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our program. And quietly, lovingly, I walk up to him and say, are you an idiot? Page 164, there's 194 pages till you get to page 164. New things in there like the doctor's opinion, the table of contents, the preface. You know, important information to determine the difference between us and them. You know, them, the social drinker. I don't know what they are. It describes it in the book very specifically what a social drinker is. If that definition confuses you, try this. Go to any party. Look at those people who are drinking socially. They're walking around going, excuse me, I seem to have lost my wine glass. Could you help me out? And you got a small group in the corner huddled by all the booze, and they're shaking their head, and they go, honey, I know where your glass is, I know where mine is, and I know where they all came from. And I ain't leaving here until we're done. And social drinkers say the most amazing, stupid things. You just ask them. You know, you're having a couple of drinks, you're starting to feel a little better. It's starting to happen for you. And you say, come on, baby, have another one. Oh, no. Why? Oh. I have to work tomorrow. So what? Have another. No, no. Why not? Oh, well, I have to drive. Me too. And I don't even have a car, but what the hell? We'll find something. Well, let's go to Tijuana. Let's go, baby. And then they'll say something that just absolutely sends me to another planet. I'll say, have another drink. They say, no, 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 no. Well, why not now? Well, you see, I'm starting to feel it. Yeah. That's it. You got it. And it's a magic thing happened. One day I figured this thing out. You know, they do not like the effect produced by alcohol. They see it as a loss of control. That is so sad. These people are like, And, you know, I guess that stuff out there is okay for them. And I'm not one of those people that think people shouldn't drink. Drink! You know, if you're an alcoholic, drink a lot. Get it done, baby. Join us. And if you're not done, it's still out there. And just because I sobered up, none of those sleazy bars have gone out of business. Not one of them. But when I finally stood in front of that judge on the 12th time, and he asked me, he said, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" And my sponsor had gotten up. And all I said there, I said, "Your Honor, I realize today that I'm wrong. And I owe the society an amends. And it probably will take me the rest of my life to pay it back, and I'll do whatever you tell me to do." And that's all I said. And he said, "Well, can you come back after lunch? I have to go to a funeral." And my answer was no. My sponsor said yes. I told him that, okay, if we're going to go for lunch, I'm going to get drunk. I'm going to face this guy with a little courage. He said, "You're going to face it with a lot of God and sobriety." We stood in front of that judge, and he didn't send me to prison. And I can't tell you why. I can tell you that 12 years later, he called me up and said, I need a favor from you. My son is having a problem with alcohol and drugs. You think you could talk to him?" This is a federal judge appointed by the President of the United States for the rest of his life. I didn't do that. Alcoholics Anonymous did that. They talk about God here. I mean, God is a big, big facet of this program. And I had this so confused. I had the program, and then I'd leave the spiritual part alone. That's how I could conceive it. You know, I got the meetings, I got there on time, and I did the commitments, and you can keep that God crap. And I didn't understand its connection. I didn't understand it at all. I'm not bright. And I went to a conference, one of these deals, and somebody stood up and shared a story. Said a story about a very spiritual man who dies and went to the gates of heaven. And for lack of anything better, he's met there by my cousin, St. Peter. And the guy says, "Well, I'm here." And Peter says, "Yep, got you on the list." He says, "Where do I go?" He said, "Well, I don't know. You got to find your own spot here in heaven. I'll show you around." And he took him to the first door, and in that door there was a whole bunch of people, hardback, straight pews, rows and rows, millions of them, all wearing starched shirts and squinting at this little book, all neat and orderly. And he said, "Ooh, this is horrible. I can't spend the rest of eternity with these people. Who are they?" He said, "These are the Protestants, and they think this is joy." "You got anything else?" "Yep." Takes him to another room, and there are people on their knees playing with these beads as fast as they can. I mean, and we're talking billions of them. And he said, "Ooh, this is worse than the last group. Who are these guys?" He says, "Well, these are the Catholics. And we can't seem to explain to them that they've already made it." He says, "You got anything else?" He says, "Yep." And he takes them in another room, and they got people with their beanies on their head reading the scroll backwards. And no. He takes them to another room. They have people under 10 going, blah, 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 blah. He takes them to another room. People on their knees facing the east and speaking a language you understand. I mean, he takes them to room after room, and he says, "Do you have anything else?" St. Peter goes, "Wait. Yes. And he takes him to a room, and he cracks the door open. And the first thing he notices is a smell of fresh brewed coffee. Clouds of stale cigarette smoke. He looks inside and peeps, sees people scratching and cussing and talking dirty and rubbing and laughing. And he said, "Wow. I don't even know who these people are, but I have an enormous sense of peace and ease and comfort. And I can and will spend the rest of eternity with these people." And as he walks through the door, he looks back and says, curiously, "Who are they?" And St. Peter backs up and says, "You know, we don't know." And the odd thing is, they won't tell us. But all they want to do is stay here just one day at a time. And I had with my friend Ron Wynn, a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who passed away, and I wear his camel. Told me I had what he called was a BFO, which is a bright flash of the obvious. And I called up my sponsor, at that time it was Barney. And I said, "Barney!" He said, "What?" I said, "Guess what?"
He said, "What?"
I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous has nothing to do with religion. It has all to do with spirituality." Now, Barney just celebrated 30 years of sobriety. This was not a new piece of information for him. And he looked at me and he went, "You're a bright study, kid. Welcome." And it just takes what it takes. There's no rush here. You don't graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't. I learn something new every day. I keep coming here, and all of a sudden I have now found the God of my own understanding. I have joined the human race. I heard a guy say once, "I come to Alcoholics Anonymous not for what I did, but for what I haven't done. And what I haven't done is grow up. What I haven't done is become a member of society. I haven't been all of those things. And I learned how to do them here. The book gives me directions, and you show me the way." You know, and I'm overwhelmed. I love conferences. I'm very blessed here. My wife is here with me this weekend, and I was supposed to speak at a conference in Arizona that got moved to Mexico. That's how AAs do it, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't know who was supposed to pick me up, and I was standing at the airport forever and a day, it seemed like, and the Al-Anon speaker showed up, and she said, "I have a ride for you." I said, I didn't come this far to be rescued by the Al-Anons now. And I dearly love Al-Anon. And this red truck drove by, and this big blonde, and I went, "That's my ride." I didn't know who it was, but that was my ride. It turned out that was my ride. We drove to Mexico, and we talked all the way down then. We talked all the way back, and we talked on the phone for a year, and a relationship ensued, and we got married. And, you know, we celebrated 5 years of marriage. That's not a big deal except for alcoholics. Alcoholics measure their marriage in dog years. Other people have 5 years. We celebrated 35 years of marriage. And because of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother passed away, and when she passed away, I had cleaned up all the wreckage of the past. And when she was dying of brain cancer and couldn't know a single soul who was in there, I walked into the room from California to New York, and I walked in that room, and here's a woman who is just about dead. She sat up in bed and she said, "My son is here." That was the last word she said before she passed away. I didn't do that. Alcoholics Anonymous did that. A loving God, as he expressed himself, did that. You folks showed me how to do that. My father was alone and goofy, and I said to him one day, "Why don't you just sell your house and move in with me?" And he did. I thought he'd like last 6 months. He lasted almost 10 years. And in that time, joy came into my life, and joy brought a son, and we created a family. And I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic. I don't know how to do that stuff. I would come here every day, and he'd say, "Well, just do it today." And he showed me how. And when my father passed away, I was speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife came home and found him had expired. You know, and the people in this fellowship gathered around us. When Ron Wynn got sick and died of cancer, I took care of him to the day he died. He showed me how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We sat in his room or my room for 5 years, three times a week, and read that book word by word, line by line. He unlocked the magic in it. These conferences are wonderful. These are great pit stops. These are magnificent times. We get to meet and greet and hug and rub and kind of get a little energy boost and like, oh, God, I haven't seen you in a year. And Lord, isn't this great? But that's not really all that Alcoholics Anonymous is for me. Alcoholics Anonymous is when it's in your home. It's in your car. It's in your job. It's in your family. This is not a program for me that's about anything but the way in which I now live my life. And I'm eternally grateful for that. And I didn't even know that when I came here. I didn't know what I was walking into. I walked in here stupid and arrogant and fearful. And you just said, it's okay. Have a seat. We'll show you. You know, when she came to that house and brought that little 8-year-old boy, I mean, it was great. He did all kinds of things. We played a little league together, and, you know, I got involved in that, and they let me coach. Oh, sure, I'll be in charge of the children. And then later on, he stopped playing, and now I'm an umpire. I love being an umpire. Take out all your hostility on those people. You're out. And you're really out. You know, and I used to tell him all things. I said, don't you ever do that. He looked at me and says, but if I don't get to do those things, I can't work on my story. And now he's a teenager. And he's grown fangs. And he looks at me and we talk about stuff. And you know, he's a sweet kid. He's just a teenager. I don't know if he's alcoholic. You know, Joy and I don't know how to do that. You know, we come here and we ask. You know, my life today is magnificent. And then one day I went to the doctor and I got notified that I have a disease called hepatitis C, which is not unique now, I found out, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it creates a side effect called cirrhosis of the liver. I figured, gee, I didn't get cirrhosis while I was drinking, so now I got it while I've been sober. And I have a rather advanced case. And April 24th, I went to the hospital. And April 27th, they weren't quite sure I was leaving the hospital. And I was pretty sick. And my wife was frightened. And I was in a coma, so I really didn't know what was going on. But the rooms were never empty because of Alcoholics Anonymous. People would show up at the ICU and they say, I'm sorry, only immediate members of the family. And black guys would show up and Indian guys would show up and Muslims would show up. And he's, that's my brother. That's my father. And I mean, the rooms were packed. And odd people started walking in the hospital and they go, down there, down there. He's down there. I mean, in the room, I mean, they couldn't fit them all in the room. And people would say, who is that guy? And people stand outside, sorry, we're not giving autographs today. I didn't do that. Alcoholics Anonymous did that. The people that I didn't know how much I was part of their lives and how much they were part of mine. We don't know this stuff. You stick around here and the deal is just unbelievable. My time is up with you guys tonight. And I'm going to tell you that coming here, I didn't know what I was going to say and I still don't know really what I said. And it doesn't matter. It only matters that I can tell you that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the best thing that ever happened to me, and I didn't even know it. I didn't know it. I'm going to close with three prayers a friend of mine by the name of Ted Harbaugh gave them to me. Polly knows them well. Dave knows them well. He used to go to that meeting in Seal Beach on Monday night, you know, and you know, when it's kind of cool, I can come here, and there are people that I know from the Pacific Group here, and there are people that I know from Seal Beach, and there are people I know from Long Beach, and there are people that I know from work, and there are people that I watch come into the rooms, and now you know me a little bit. And as this weekend unfolds, I'll know more of you. And see, my name is Peter Fleischman. I am not anonymous inside the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My phone number is 619-582-5557. If you're ever in San Diego, California, pick up the phone. You have welcomed me into your home. I will welcome you into mine. That's what we do here. When the hand of AA reaches out, you bet I'm going to be there. even though it is inconvenient. Service work is inconvenient. Sobriety is an absolute must, and I'll do whatever it takes. I made that commitment from the day I came here, and I reaffirm that every single day. Ted left me with three prayers. I'm going to leave them with you as we travel off into this weekend and have some fun. First prayer, if you're new, I pray to God you keep coming back. Listen to the music. Music, it's the love and the laughter of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You heard it here tonight. You should hear it at every meeting you go to. If you don't hear the love and the laughter of the Fellowship of Alcoholics in that meeting that you're going to, don't go to that meeting. If it ain't doing the job, start one. Get a resentment. Buy a coffee pot. Read the traditions, the 12 concepts, the 12 steps, and carry the message. If it wasn't for guys like Clarence Snyder, we'd still be in Akron, Ohio. He was a pissed off little guy. That's a fact. But, you know, he helped spread Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not the mentally well group here. But we are passionate about our program and our fellowship. And I hope to pray to God that you keep coming back and one day you'll understand the words and sing with us. If you're new, I pray to God that you put your hand in ours. Not mine, ours, collectively. But don't ever let go, because if you let go, we might lose you, and we don't want to lose anybody if we can help it. The third prayer, which is perhaps a little difficult. I pray to God you keep coming back and let us love you just the way God made you, just the way God brought you to us. You know, I came here dirty. I came here real dirty on the outside. But more importantly, I was dirty on the inside. And, you know, a new suit of clothes and a haircut doesn't clean that up. And I thought I had done some things here that I could never share with another human being and live the lifestyle that I was going to have to be totally ashamed of. You know, and I was about 2 years sober, and I was at the Southern California Convention, and I happened to know that Polly was there, and so was Dave. And I was feeling a little lonely and goofy and 2 years sober and didn't feel like I fit in because everybody knew each other except for me. Ever feel that way? I'd sit in the back going, I'm not going to shake their hand. So I'm walking around the lobby. They're having the banquet. I can't afford to eat. You know, feeling sorry for myself. I look across the lobby and there's the guy I shot and left for dead in Palm Springs. That's what I said. And I know he's got a gun. And all I got is one of them AA badges. Hi, my name is Peter. And I am frozen. And he walks up to me. And the room went still. Everything was in slow motion. It was the most bizarre experience I'd ever had. And he comes up to me and he wraps his arms around me and he's crying. And he asked me if there's any way that I could forgive him. I didn't do that. Alcoholics Anonymous did that. A loving God, as he expressed himself in the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts, that book and you people. We are friends today. He lives on the East Coast. He tells the story slightly differently. He's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and sober now longer than I am. See, he has what I want. And I'm just going to keep following him. So I pray to God, if you knew, that you keep coming back and let us love you just the way you are until the real miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous happens. Not that you learn to love yourself. I'm sorry, folks. My opinion, that's crap. I have been loving myself forever. I loved myself for 34 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I loved myself for a long time in AA. We have a conference in the spring roundup, and every year we pick a theme. Unlike you guys, you stick with one that works. We got to come up with a new one every year. So guess what one of the topics were? Me in 2003. I almost puked. They came to their senses. But let us love you just the way you are. And then the real miracle happens, that you learn to love another human being unconditionally. One of the great paradoxes in Alcoholics Anonymous. As we give it away, we keep it. As we surrender, we win. I can't thank you enough for having me and hosting myself and my wife. And I'm so delighted to be here. I hope you have just a magnificent weekend, and I wish you all the very best. Thanks for having me.